it's not a weakness to ask for help or ask for guidance. And I think that a lot of times when we have big decisions we have to make in our lives, if we can bring in those other people that have been in that situation, they can guide us, they can make help us make a more educated decision in the future too.
Hi, I'm Sylvia Beckerman. Join me today as I talk to an extraordinary woman who is changing the world by making a difference in her life and the lives of those around her.
My name is Susan Combs. I am the CEO of Combs & Company, which is a full-service insurance brokerage firm. I'm also the founder of a nonprofit called Pancakes for Roger. Both are headquartered in New York City. And welcome to Sylvia and me.
Susan, thank you so much. I'm glad we could do this. And as you said, you have a full-service insurance agency, which you started at the age of 26.
Yeah.
And also, you were named the youngest national president in the over 85-year history of women in insurance and financial services, and the first female broker of the year winner for Benefits Pro.
Yeah.
So you've done a couple of other things other than, oh, you own an insurance company. I think, did you just mention the benefits from the book?
What do you mean the benefits?
Okay.
Of the book?
So proceeds from the sale of the book, Pancakes for Roger, a mentorship guide for slaying dragons. The proceeds from the sale of the book benefits the University of Missouri School of Law Veterans Clinic to further their mission to help vets and their families navigate the VA claims and appeals process. You talk a lot about mentors who are very, very important in life, and a lot of people don't really understand the importance of a mentor and how mentors can be many different things. They can be senior of you, they could be peers, they could be parents, they could be coworkers, friends. You talk about that you have mentors from all over, but your number one, your top mentor was your dad.
Yeah.
Can you, before we get into Pancakes for Roger, can you tell us a little bit about your father?
Yeah. So my dad was, I mean, he was, you know, a lot of people said he was a giant, but my father's stature was not that of a giant. I mean, I think he was 5'9", 5'10" at his peak. But my father, he was a civilian judge. He was also a kid that grew up on a dairy farm in northwest corner, Missouri. We actually still have both those farms in our family still today. And then he was also in the military. So my father served in three branches of the armed forces for 39 years and 4 months. But my father was a mentor to many. I mean, he wore a lot of different hats and he mentored a lot of different people. I mean, whether it be like his church board commitments or in the military or in the civilian life as an attorney or but he was just a good guy. I mean, I realized that not everybody had a great father growing up. I had one of the best, I feel. And which is evident to not only to me, but to others, because after he passed away in 2018 from Agent Orange related throat cancer, the stories that have come out from people that he's mentored or that he helped or he guided throughout their lives, whether they were children that were kind of on a wayward path and they sat in front of him when he was a judge and he gave them another shot to say a young pilot that was going to go into combat for the first time. I mean, so that was the example I had, was that, you know, you always helped others. And so that's always made me want to mentor and be mentored and also understand that it's not a weakness to ask for help or ask for guidance. And I think that a lot of times when we have big decisions we have to make in our lives, if we can bring in those other people that have been in that situation, they can guide us, they can make help us make a more educated decision in the future too.
Well, we're going to get into the book and the reason, you know, why not only am I interviewing you because of the book, but the way you've broken the book down. But one of the things that I really like is little things in life that make a huge impact. It's those little things. And people, again, sometimes we negate little things and we don't realize until maybe years later how impactful and they were. And it's a shame because the appreciation of that little act will have a very large impact on life. So you go ahead and you break your mantra, the slaying dragons, you break it down into four parts.
Yep.
And in between each one, you talk about syrup. And syrup on pancakes is fantastic. I want to leave to the end why pancakes for Roger, because I think it'll all come around full circle. Mm-hmm. So the first part of your book is called Self. Mm-hmm. And you started off with Choose Your Own Adventure. Mm-hmm. Can you kind of go, what do you mean by choosing your own adventure? And how did that play into where you are now? Because I know it had a big part in many ways to where you are now.
So I don't know if you remember those type of books when you were a kid, the Choose Your Own Adventure books. I don't even know if they have them anymore. But they were just always those really cool books that you're reading part of a story, and then you come to kind of a crossroads in the story, and you can go left or you can go right. And depending upon which path you choose, then the narrative of your life goes in a different path, or the narrative of the story does. And so that was always something that was just fun for me as a kid, that I always enjoyed those books. And, you know, I grew up in a town of 986 people in the northwest corner of Missouri. I mean, far different than New York City, where I've lived for over two decades now. But I had parents that basically said, the world is bigger than your backyard, and go out and explore it. And if you find your way that way, that's okay. But there's no shame in coming back home and building a life here. So even though, I mean, I graduated high school with 15 people, and the majority of them have kind of stayed around where I grew up, but I found a different way. I mean, my father always said I was too fast for Missouri, and New York just worked for me. I mean, New York worked for me from day one. And so depending upon, I mean, when I look at my life and look at the different opportunities that I've been given, my most success comes from when I've stayed open to something. So when I've come to a crossroads and there was, you know, choosing your own adventure, being open, obtaining information, and then making an educated decision on what was going to be the best thing for me at the time, and then just kind of ride it on out.
That's great advice. Again, a lot of people don't realize that there are choices to be made, and you can move forward if you don't let fear and anxiety prevent you from opening that door and stepping into that adventure, because you could make it your own. I love this one. Drive the car.
Yes.
And it's a great metaphor for life. Tell us how you were able to use that, especially during the time when your dad was in hospice.
Mm-hmm. So drive the car was something that we were taught at a young age. I mean, if you grew up in a rural area or a farming area, a lot of us are driving at a very young age. I mean, I think I was driving at like 8 or 9 years old on the farm. But then when it came to highway driving, we waited until we had our permits, because got to remember, our dad was the judge. And so my dad just always had a cadence when we were learning how to highway drive, that he said, drive the car, drive the car, drive the car. And so literally when we were learning how to drive on the highway, my dad would grab the steering wheel and just jerk it and make you go off the road. And you had to keep your composure. You had to take your foot off the accelerator, coast down, and then assess the situation and just keep driving the car. Be the best driver in the world, but you have to be aware of your surroundings and the other drivers out there. So it became actually a metaphor for life, that a lot of times it's just first things first. A lot of times if there's a big challenge or a big dragon to slay in front of us, it can seem too big and we can't figure out how to do it. And sometimes we just have to stop, kind of do first things first, drive the car, assess the situation, see how it's going to work. And so when my father was dying from Agent Orange related throat cancer and he was on hospice, kind of the drive the car moment for us was, you know, any of your listeners that have dealt with somebody on hospice, you know, that it's about comfort and about care. And so when it comes to the medication, it can be, you know, basically a pharmacy in your house, of very high end, medications to make the person that's dying comfortable. And so we had had those medications out. And one morning, my dad took the wrong medications. He took his nighttime meds instead of his daytime meds. So it wasn't a dangerous situation, so to speak, but what it resulted in is he wasn't able to just interact. And that was actually a day that I was flying back to New York. My dad couldn't even wake up to say goodbye to me. And when somebody's on hospice, you know that every chance, you know, every time that you leave, that could be the last. And, you know, I remember my brother just trying to wake up my dad. And I said, you know what, this is a drive the car moment. And what we're going to do from now on is any medication that he shouldn't have access to, we're just going to put away. And then even at night, when he wakes up and if he's in pain, we will fill the syringes on the proper amounts and leave them out and he can self-administer them. So it was a way to make things safe, a way to make things, you know, a lot of times, especially when somebody's on hospice, a lot of things are out of sight, out of mind. So he didn't even realize that we had put the medications away. But he knew that, okay, if I got up at night and I needed something, that this is what I could take. And then it just, we never had to deal with that situation again.
It's assessing the situation and figuring out how to basically pivot and make things easier.
Absolutely.
I like this. If you don't roar for yourself, which a lot of us are afraid to do because we're told that we really shouldn't be, it's vanity, and it's not. So why did you put that one in there?
So I was actually speaking at a college here in New York, and they had had other speakers, and it was a bunch, there was this program that was called actually Executives on Campus. So it's a mentorship program that the Baruch College, I'll name it, has, where they have people that are executive level or business owners come in and mentor a lot of their students. So I was asked to be a keynote at one of these events. And a woman that went before me was in leadership for a very large computer company that I'm not going to say. And I'm sitting at the table and I'm with a whole bunch of college students. And the woman says from the platform, she said, "Don't roar after the kill." She said, "You know, you've done a good job, take pride in the good job," and everything like that. And I'm sitting there just kind of seething a little bit, you know? And so when I get up to the podium and I'm talking and everything like that, I said, "I'm going to have you look at it a little bit different way." I said, "I want you to roar after the kill, because if you don't roar for yourself, nobody's going to roar for you." And so it wasn't meant to be in a braggadocious way. It was meant to be in a more motivational way, because a lot of times, and I think especially as women, I actually write a series for a magazine that's all about, it's called What's the Good News, Ladies? And it's about getting women to get in the habit of talking about their accomplishments and saying what they've accomplished in the past 12 months. And then we parlayed that into a social media strategy called Wonder Woman Wednesday, where we highlight some of their things that they've done. Because I think that sometimes as women, and depending upon the generations too, we're told to be quiet, to speak when spoken to not be braggadocious, because it's rude, it's arrogant. Nobody likes somebody that's has too big of an ego. But this is a little bit different. It's more about empowering women and empowering people that maybe feel like they don't have a voice and speaking up for themselves, because there's nothing wrong with saying like, "Hey, I won this award today," or "Hey, I'm pretty happy about this," or, you know, if you would like to read this article or this magazine, here's the link to it. I'm very happy with how it turned out, type of thing. So it just is a way to kind of have confidence in yourself. And there's nothing wrong with talking about some of the things that you've done along the way too.
Absolutely not. And as you said, women, it is a generational thing, which has been handed on for generations and generations. Which hopefully is now really, we're finding that women do have a voice and learning how to use that voice in a way that's empowering, not in a way that says, "Oh, look at me," but in a way that says, "Oh, look at me, I've done this." I mean, really, that's a good thing.
Yeah,
that's great. And one of the quotes that that you have, which I want to ask you, why is it important? I know why it's important, but I'd like you to tell us, get active in your own rescue. I love that.
My favorite quote. So that's actually part of a Marcus Aurelius quote. And that is my absolute favorite quote. So I think that a lot of times people can kind of have the victim mentality instead of the survivor mentality. And so look, I've had trauma just like other people have had trauma in their lives. And you can either say, I'm a survivor or I'm a victim. And sometimes too, I think that people wait for a hero to step in and save them. And, or they kind of stand in the middle of the room and say, like, who's going to help me out of this situation? How do I figure this out? Instead of saying, hey, let's be active in our own rescue. So I think that sometimes there's nothing wrong with wallowing in self-pity and saying like, hey, you know what? This sucks. Recognize the suck and then say like, what can I do about it? What can I, who can I bring in? How can I overcome this obstacle? How can I be empowered to take control of the situation and have myself come out on the other end?
Yeah. And as you said, it's not about doing it all yourself, but it's also not about waiting to be rescued.
Absolutely.
Coming up with a plan is helping yourself rescue yourself.
Yeah. And
waiting,
you know what?
For someone to come, you know, throw you the lifeboat.
Well, and I also, you know, I grew up in a military family. So military wives, man, they have to be resourceful, especially if the guys are deployed or they're gone. So my dad was gone quite a bit growing up. I mean, my dad was a very, you know, present father when he was home, but he did travel a lot for work. And there were a lot of things that, I mean, I remember calling from New York back to Missouri one time and my mother's like, Susan, can't talk now. Your dad's down in Panama. Some pump's backed up. I'm on the phone with the plumber. I got this going on. And I just got off the phone and I laughed and I looked at my husband and I said, your mother would have been standing in the center of the room saying, who's going to save me? Like she wouldn't have known what to do. So it's, you know, it's also, you know, having that grit and that moxie and, you know, especially when I was growing up, my dad was gone quite a bit. I mean, my mother had to have that because there was nobody that was going to come and save her type of thing. So she had to figure things out.
Well, it's the same thing as being a single,
absolutely,
single parent.
Absolutely.
You need grit and moxie in order to get through life. There's one thing, another piece in this first part, which is called self, which your father, I believe, taught you the three facets of life.
Yeah. So that one, so I graduated college in 2001. And if you guys remember the job market, those of you in the job market pre-9/11, 2001, it was sick. There was a lot of money to be had. The .com was going on. I mean, there was a lot of different opportunities. And I graduated with 8 job offers. And so I really had the pick of the litter and I could go wherever I wanted to, but I did want to come to the East Coast. So the spring break before I graduated college, my dad and I came out here to the East Coast and we went to all these different locations. So we flew into Boston and then we drove to Connecticut because we stayed in New London at the submarine base because my dad was a general. We could stay at bases and get basically a house for $20 a night. And it kind of was nice.
Not bad.
But I remember that was my first experience with a nor'easter. And so your non-East Coasters, it's kind of like a little mini hurricane and it rains sideways and you can't see. And I remember we were driving the car, right? And it was driving from Boston to New London and then New London down to Hartford, where we took a train into New York City. And my dad kept saying, you know, Susan, this is going to be your life. He's like, you got to figure it out and you got to drive the car. But when we were driving during that time, he said, you know, Susan, he said, your life is comprised of a lot of different things. There's a lot of experiences that shape you. There's a lot of the different things going on. But he said, when you really boil it down, it really kind of comes down to three facets. So he said, you have the place that you live, you have the thing that you do for a living, and you have the person that you're with. And he said, if you can line 3 out of 3, he's like, you're living a golden life. He said, even if you're happy with 2 out of 3, you're doing pretty good. But he said, if you're happy with 1 or none, he said, only you are the person that can get off your butt and do something about it. So it's just been something that, man, I mentor a lot. And usually women are the people who I mentor. If somebody starts complaining and they're talking about a bad marriage, they're talking about a bad boss, they're talking about how their apartment is leaking and they hate their landlord, I'm like, oh, you're kind of on a 0 for 3 on your facets. And so they say, well, what's that all about? And so it's just kind of a way of bringing things back and saying, look, you know, do kind of a check-in with yourself. And say like, hey, is, you know, I live in New York City. New York City works for me for right now. It stimulates me. It's a lot of fun. It's fast paced. I don't think that there's any place better for women in business than New York City because the opportunities are endless. I have a fantastic husband. I didn't always. My first husband wasn't so fantastic. But my second, yeah, it does happen and that's okay. But my second husband, he and I will have been together for 20 years coming up in July. And he's great. And then I love what I do for a living. And so it just, it works out, but sometimes there's going to be ebb and flow. And if you understand that, hey, you might have a bad day at work, it doesn't mean that the whole job is horrible and that you want to throw that out. It's just saying, hey, what modifications can I make to the next day to make me more empowered and make things better and have my facets all balanced out.
Okay. I want to now jump into the second part. I know we've gone over a lot of the first part, which is self, and there's more in there, but I want to move on to the second part because you almost started talking about it. The second part is called love. Yeah. And you break it down into several different sections. And I'd like to, first of all, you have find the right fit, and you also have connecting emotionally. Mm-hmm. So why don't you talk about those two right now?
You know, I honestly think that a lot of people don't know what a good relationship looks like. I think that there's a lot of people that come from homes that they didn't have a quote unquote good marriage model for them. And there's nothing wrong with that, but it's just, you don't know any different. And so I think a lot of times when it comes to relationships, and I talk about this a lot when I mentor, you know, girls in college and saying that, oh, he's the one. And I'm like, eh, you're going to change a lot between 23 and 26. May you want to hold on for that. But it's, you know, I think that a lot of times people just don't understand what it's like to be good and to have a true partnership. So when somebody's telling me 3 months into a relationship, they're crying every night, I'm like, it's not going to get better. It's only going to get worse. I'm like, because that's the easy time. You haven't had any life kind of hit you during that time. But kind of having that balance and finding a true partnership. I mean, you know, we were talking about, you know, roaring and everything like that. Man, my husband roars for me all the time. He's my biggest cheerleader and he is not intimidated by my excess and he embraces it and he honors it and he actually supports it. So, and not every guy's like that. And, you know, I think a lot of times too, people can settle for relationships because they don't want to be alone. And yeah. I think that if you can understand that, hey, when you're with yourself, you're enough. And you're in the best company being by yourself. And then that the person that you end up finding a place with is to enhance you. And so if you can have somebody that enhances your life and adds to it, then that's a much better partnership and a much better place to be than somebody that you feel is kind of draining you and just isn't in your corner all the time.
You have to be able to be alone.
Yeah.
With yourself, because that means you accept yourself. It's very difficult if you are not able to be alone with yourself, because then you're just going into a relationship looking for someone to fulfill that piece.
Yeah. And that's not fair.
Yeah. You have to be 100% of yourself, each partner, and then you bring something together. And you talk about, you know, everyone says they want their best friend. And how about liking the person?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's very important.
Yeah. My husband always says, he's like, I love you, but he's like, but I like you. And he said, some days that's more important because you have the, I mean, 20 years together, we have a very big foundation together, but we like being around each other. I mean, that's the thing that I probably love more about my marriage than anything else is if we had a third person there and we were out to lunch, that third person would never feel like a third wheel, like that they were kind of crashing a husband and wife's date night. They would feel like it's three friends hanging out. And so I just always like that because we do have such a good friendship, but we allow ourselves to be ourselves. I mean, last night, I'll tell you, I had a lot of things go wrong for me yesterday. I mean, I shattered a massive piece of glass. I knocked over a big bottle of water. A guy was walking down the street. He spit and it hit me. And then I lost my, oh yeah, I know, but I lost my, my composure on that man. And then the train went to shit. And so it's just like, and so a lot of things went wrong for me. And when I came into the house, it smelled like broccoli and I hate broccoli. I'm like, come on, man, this is not my day. But you know what my husband was okay with is I took my dinner and I said, I'm going to go watch it in the bedroom and watch some Law and Order. He's like, okay. So it's just like, he gives me the freedom to be myself. And he knows like, hey, everything kind of went in disarray. I mean, we joked about it because he said, can you pick up the mail on the way up? And I said, are you sure? I think it might burst into flames, you know? But it's like, you know, having that understanding and having that space, I think is so, so important.
There's one other one that I think is exceedingly important. And that's know your worth. Just showing up is a big part.
Yeah.
You talk about your father's friend, Ed.
Oh, yeah.
And visiting your dad. Can tell us that story because I think it talks so much to friendship, showing up and being able to assess the situation and know what's needed.
Yeah. So Ed Manring is a dear, dear family friend. Ed and my dad actually went to law school together. And then they had a similar path. They had a deep friendship for decades. And so when my father was on hospice, I mean, people that have dealt with people on hospice, my father had a feeding tube and he was also on oxygen. And there's good days and there's bad days. And so there would be people that would want to visit my dad. But we always asked them to call and check in to see what kind of day it was. And so I had talked to Ed, I don't know, like a week prior. And he said to me, he's like, I want to come up and see your dad. And I said, okay. I said, you know, let's plan on a day and then we'll just kind of coordinate and make sure that things are still going fine. And so, you know, one of the days he had wanted to come up, it wasn't a good day. And so then I called him and I said, hey, he's having a good day. I think this will be good. And so he's just like, okay. He's like, I'll be up there in an hour. So he came up to our house and I had told Ed before he came in, I said, because my father had Agent Orange related throat cancer. And so his speech had become drastically changed. And my brother and my mother and I could all understand him just because we were used to it. Yeah. But if it was somebody that was kind of coming into the situation new, it was hard for them to understand. So I told Ed beforehand, I said, look, I said, I'll stay in the room so I can help translate if you need it. But I said, Dad is having some problems with his speech and hard to understand. He said, okay. So Ed came to the door that day and he's like, I'm prepared, Susan. And I said, okay, what do you got? And he had flashcards. And one said, yes. One said, no. One said, maybe. And one said, bullshit. And so he went into the living room with my dad and my dad had the oxygen machine and we turned the oxygen machine off because it was so loud and it was easier to understand. And so if you've dealt with people on oxygen, if their brains are active, then even when the oxygen's off, then their oxygen levels typically stay up. But once their brain starts kind of, if they start falling asleep or say they get bored, then their oxygen levels kind of creep down. And that's why you have to have the oxygen level up or, you know, on all the time. So Ed handed the flashcards to my dad and my dad just immediately smirked. And so they started talking about, Ed was still practicing. So he said, do you want to know what's going on with some cases? And so what's going on? They started, you know, Ed started telling stories and my dad was just so engaged. And then they would talk about old cases. Then my dad would smile and everything. And, you know, Ed was there for about an hour. And, When he left, I walked Ed out to his truck and I said, you don't know how much he enjoyed this. And I said, we have proof that he enjoyed it because I said, I just checked his oxygen. And I said, he's at 97%. I said, normally not being on his oxygen for an hour, I said, he'd be in the 70s or he'd be in the low 80s. And I said, so this was such an engaging visit for him that I know he enjoyed it. And so it was just one of those things that, you know, it's platonic love. You know, things don't have to be a romantic love, but Ed had such a respect for my dad. My dad had such a respect for him. They had worked together as colleagues for so many years. And it was important for Ed to just treat my dad like a person instead of like a patient. And it was evident that because the oxygen level stayed up. So it was such a beautiful thing to witness as my dad's child, because I knew he enjoyed it. And, you know, my father passed away probably about a week or two after that. And so the end was so near, and that was really the last good visit that my dad had with anybody before he passed. So it was such a gift to be able to witness that and kind of hold on to that memory for myself. And I do actually a lot of expert witnessing in my career, and Ed has become my mentor in that capacity.
And as that part said, know your worth, just showing up is a big part, and Ed knew exactly what his part was, and he came prepared. Our last few minutes, I want you to tell me why the name Pancakes for Roger. Yeah. What's the symbolism of pancakes?
So Pancakes for Roger, I mean, okay, it's a nonprofit, it's a keynote, it's a fundraising effort for the Veterans Clinic at the University of Missouri, but it all came back to a simple request from my father. So my dad and I, very similar personality, very type A, very scheduled, very logical in our thought process. And so my dad and I just had a cadence. And so when I moved from when I moved from New York City back to Missouri to help care for him, he and I just had a system. I would get up in the morning at 5 a.m. I would check on him. If he was good, I'd go to the gym. I'd come back. I'd check on him again. If he was good, I'd go get cleaned up for the day. And then I'd come back to, we were lucky enough to have hospice at home. And I would go to his hospital bed, get him, you know, kind of rallied for the day, help him with his tube feeding for the morning, and then get him set in his recliner. And then I would literally work in my childhood home at the coffee table with my laptop for the rest of the day. And if he needed something, I was right there. So one morning I got to the kitchen and he was there and he had a placemat and he had set the table. And I looked at my dad and I said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "Well, I want pancakes for breakfast." And I mean, this man had a feeding tube for over a year. And, you know, as I mentioned before, when somebody's on oxygen, if their levels go low, they can have some confusion. And my father never once in a year had asked for any type of food. He knew this was, hey, all my nutrition has to go through my feeding tube. And that's how it is. Like, he accepted that. And that's how we rolled with it. Sometimes he would say something smelled good, but my niece at the time was about a year old. And so he would just hold the baby and he would be happy sitting at the table with us holding the baby. But that morning he asked for pancakes and I looked at him and I said, "Oh, Dad, I mean, there's nothing in this world that I want to give you than pancakes for breakfast, but you have a feeding tube. We're on hospice. We have a DNR. I'm like, if I give you pancakes and you choke, we're probably done here. And I don't think we're quite ready to be done." And so my dad looked at me and he said, "Oh, yes, I can." Matt said I could. Matt's my brother and Matt's a nurse. And he wasn't there that morning. So I knew we were dealing with some oxygen deprivation, some confusion. So I said, "You know, let me see what I can do." So I took the tube feeding formula over to the microwave because the general always wanted to heat it up for 14 seconds, never 13, never 15. He would know. And so heat it up for the 14 seconds. I took it over the table and I put down the pitcher and he said, "What's that?" And I said, "That's your syrup." And so since I had been talking to him, his oxygen levels had started rallying around. He understood and he kind of smiled and he nodded. And so a couple of weeks later, my father passed away and I took one day off of work when I came back to New York, because I just needed one day to just not deal with anything, not check my phone, not check emails, just be. And my husband said to me, he said, "Why don't we go to the diner and have some pancakes for your dad?" And so we went to the Bel Air Diner in Queens, New York, and my husband took a picture of me. And I shared about the interaction with my father and said, "If you're so inclined, why don't you go have some pancakes for Roger and remember about all the little things you have in life, because we all have something to be grateful for. And as we all know, our lives can change in the blink of an eye. So go out and have some pancakes and remember those great blessings that we have." So it was just me sharing part of my heart. It wasn't even supposed to go anywhere. I mean, I was just taking a picture and freaking talking. I mean, it was just sharing some of my sorrow and just some love for my father. And then people started having pancakes and they were taking pictures and they were texting me, "Hey, I had pancakes for your dad. And I can't have pancakes now and not think about them." And so then the University of Missouri School of Law Veterans Clinic had a Pancakes for Roger breakfast in February. And so my father's birthday was February 22nd. So what it turned into is a fundraising effort for the clinic. So the month of February, for every pancake-loving picture that we get on social media, where people use the hashtag Pancakes for Roger or they tag our social media accounts, we make a donation to the clinic in my father's honor. So we're not asking people for money. We're just saying, "Hey, have some pancakes, talk about service. And the such the cool thing for me now is like, we've been doing this fundraiser for 6 years and kids are growing up on Pancakes for Roger. Parents are talking to their kids about military service, about gratefulness, about gratitude. And it's just so heartwarming to see. And then in December of 2023, I officially incorporated as a nonprofit because I know there's so much more work we can do. And so even though, you know, I have a love for the clinic and we will always support the clinic, the mission of the nonprofit is to unite veterans with funding opportunities to do good in their backyards and beyond. So probably within the next year, we're building an endowment. We're going to be able to give grants to veterans that want to do service projects, or, you know, maybe they're just down on their luck and they just need a little help. But eventually what I want to turn it into in the next few years is doing even like a soldier Shark Tank. Because I started my first company at 26 years old. And if somebody said, hey, here's a grant for $5,000, $10,000, something like that, that would have helped tremendously. Help set up your website, get insurance, get phone systems, you know, maybe, you know, hire your first person. I mean, it just would have helped so much. So it's kind of cool to see how it's growing and evolving. I mean, we actually held a weightlifting competition called the Dragon Slaying Competition. We held it in Queens this year. We're going to be doing a virtual competition this summer. We're going to be doing a walk, like a virtual run walk. And then we're just excited to see where it's going to go for next year too.
Well, Susan, this takes us full circle for the first thing that we were talking about, that the little things in life have such a huge impact. Where can people find out more about you?
I'm pretty Googleable. So you put in Susan L. Combs, you can pretty much find me. But like if it's an insurance thing, you go to combsandco.com. But pancakesforroger.org is the website.
Susan, I want to thank you so much for being here with me today.
Thank you so much for having me, Sylvia. I appreciate it.
Thank you for joining me today. If you liked what you heard, please share it with another person you think would be interested. And if you haven't already, please subscribe.
This has been a Life of Prey production.